Hey, you're listening to The Morning Show with Aaron, and in the studio I've got Dr. Oliver McLeod. Good morning.
Good morning, kia ora, Aaron.
So we're not talking medicine today. You're a doctor of?
Doctor of rocks.
Doctor of rocks. A rock doctor. Yeah. Cool. Last time we spoke to you was 2020, you reminded me.
Yes.
And you're
yes.
in the middle of a Kickstarter campaign to do a geological survey, basically, of Mount Kareoi and the surrounding area.
Yes.
And given that I'm sitting here now, folks, you should see me. I've got a big map next to me here, and I've got the book with all the information on the other side of me. So that was obviously a success because you've produced the goods. Did you get how much? The Kickstarter campaign was a success?
Yeah, thankfully it was a success, and yeah. It was about 15K raised.
Okay.
And that was enough to really kickstart all of the mapping work, and I think it's the first crowdfunded geology project ever done in New Zealand.
Doesn't surprise me because we have there's a real strong identity in this area, like in the community. So, yeah, there's a bit of power in that. 15,000 doesn't sound like that much, though. Like, you haven't been working full time for the last 4 years, I imagine.
No. Well, so how that worked is that was the seed fund.
Yeah.
And recently that money was spent. A lot of it was kept aside right till the very end for printing the book.
Oh, yeah.
And all of the map print production. It's quite a detailed process to print books, and all of it was printed in New Zealand as well. That was something I really wanted to do.
Yeah. And so, that was part of the deal with the Kickstarter, was the people who funded you
were
going to get a map and book.
Yeah, and actually, so a lot of those books were sent out earlier this week.
Yes.
So it's really all just happening now. After it's been almost 4 years.
Yeah. So that naturally, that's how it worked. Were there? Was it just one level? Sometimes there's different levels of funding. Like people who want to give more can give more. And
I created all of these different reward tiers, and it was get a copy of the map or the map in the book or some art prints of from a scanning electron microscope or I even offered lectures. Like I'll come and give a lecture to any audience you want and that sort of thing.
So my wife and I, we must have been at the bottom tier, was it? We got the book and the map.
Well, the map, a copy of the map and the book was sort of like the main level.
We won't call it bottom, we'll call it the standard.
Yeah, the essential.
It is essential, isn't it? Because why would you do it otherwise? and then after that was some artwork. People could get some artwork.
Yeah, get some artwork. So I went to Victoria University a couple of years ago and took all these pictures of crystals from the mountain.
Yeah, okay.
And on the electron microscope and printed them out. And they've got a real artistic quality.
Really beautiful. How microscopic are we talking?
Down the total field of view would be sort of 1 millimeter or maybe a couple millimeters at most.
Right.
Yeah, fit between different photos. They're not even photos, they're backscattered energy, which our brain interprets as a picture at the end. They're amazing, and you can see all these sort of growth rings in the crystals, like tree rings.
Really?
Yeah. And some of these will be on display soon.
So that's, if it's crystals, it's not volcanic?
So lava flows, or magmas, contain crystals. So as liquid cools down, it crystallizes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The mantle's made out of crystals. The mantle is crystalline. Lavas or magmas represent melted mantle.
Yeah.
And then as it cools down, the crystals start to form again, and then eventually they erupt. And
you talked about growth rings as if it happened over a...
Yeah.
The growth is...
Because magma chambers on volcanoes are pretty complicated.
Mm.
You have a crystal which forms, and then maybe the magma starts to heat up again and the crystal might melt a little bit and then it regrows. And on Kareoi, the crystals can have 100 growth rings on them. So they've been growing for a very long time prior to eruption.
I can see why you've got fascinated by this sort of stuff, haven't you? Is that why you started studying it and got through to having a PhD and you've kept going?
Absolutely. The fascination kind of never stopped. And there didn't seem to be many people studying it either.
Yeah, okay. So in generally or just this area?
Just in this in this particular region. So Pirongia was the PhD site, and you know, Kakapuku as well out there.
Yeah.
And then Karioi kind of followed on.
Mm.
And in some ways it's the superior map subject because you have all these coastal cliffs where you could see all the rock layers.
Oh, yeah, so it's exposed.
And the sea keeps on creating these fresh exposures.
Yeah. And that was also from a different era. Well, you used the way a geologist uses the word era would be the way I use it, but they're different times, aren't they, each eruption?
Yeah, there's, you could see it as Karioi, which is a stratovolcano, or it was a stratovolcano. It's a collection of layers of eruption deposits. Some of them could be lava flows, ash deposits, sort of collapse deposits, you know, as the mountains fallen down, and all of that is preserved as layers, and you can see them in the cliffs and then work out what happened 2.5 million years ago from that.
Yeah. Now, I realise we didn't go back. I want to go back to the Kickstarter.
Mm.
Some people could get a private lecture. Did people take that option?
Yeah, there's a handful of people around the world.
Right.
And
that was that surprising? That it was people, it surprises me that it was people out of the area.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to figure out how to give a private lecture in Hawaii, in Canada. I don't really know how to do that. I'd probably be online, but and some were like university professors who they said, "Oh, you just present online to our class," you know.
Mm.
And so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. It's and as you said, that was no one's done this before with a Kickstarter.
As far as I'm aware, I haven't. Yeah. Particularly in New Zealand, I don't think anyone's had to do it before.
Is that a comment on funding levels for research these days in this country?
It must be. But one of the things which was a beautiful consequence of kickstarting the work and the way it did was that it maintained degree of independence.
Yeah,
and it also, as it turned out, it insulated me from a lot of the other issues that came up with universities and GNS and. There's been these huge funding issues since this happened. So,
not just with this current government, I presume, but also previous one as well.
Yeah, so since 4 years ago, it's actually geoscience has got hammered. Oh, it's a great pun, but it's got hammered even more. And it's
a science pun.
And so, whereas this work, which was community supported, in the first instance, has kind of been able to survive the whole process. Which is pretty special.
Interesting. You'd think understanding geology in New Zealand was fairly important, given how live we still are in terms of, you know, the physical construction of the land.
Yeah, and it is definitely important. Volcanology has always been a bit of a funny subject that is a bit detached from the economy, and a lot of scientists who have been in volcanology over the last couple hundred years. I mean. Sometimes there's no money at all in it.
But I've been, like, in my adult life, there's been eruptions at Ruapehu.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's all within living memory that it's been happening. They weren't, like, hugely disastrous, but they were consequential. They were economically consequential.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've cottoned on to it now. But there's still an element of the research side of volcanology, which is, you know, people living in little shacks on the side of mountains and in Latin America or Africa or in North America, you know, where you've just got people doing it for love of it, monitoring volcanoes. It happens all over the world. New Zealand's one of the better countries for supporting scientists.
Okay, okay, fair enough. So was there like a lot of volunteer labour in this project, Oliver?
I'd say labour led by passion and interest. So, I mean, some people I'd give a shout out to, like Duncan Mackay, Karioi Project.
Yeah.
He was absolutely awesome in the field, supporting me clambering up and down cliffs. And
actually, those guys know their way around the mountains. So, yeah.
I was actually relying quite a lot on his knowledge of the trap lines to do some parts of the mapping. And there have been many other volunteers who've assisted in different ways throughout this project. They're all listed in the the front acknowledgements page of the book.
Yeah, it was quite a long list. And I saw
hundreds.
Yeah,
and it's just, yeah, I'm just really thankful. We wouldn't have got the map finished without all of that support.
Yeah, and also you probably worked more hours than the $15,000.
Yes. Dollars?
Oh, this is what I was wondering too.
So, yeah, absolutely. There must have been thousands of hours of combined field work and then office work as well. Getting the map ready was just sometimes, you know, there were many all-nighters done for years to get it finished.
Well, you're young enough to want to do that sort of thing, I think. I mean, hobby probably belittles it a bit, but there's like a personal, it's a personal love for you, I guess, to do this sort of stuff.
It was a personal love for the maunga.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot has changed for me. Like, I've had two children since beginning this.
Okay.
Since
you might not be doing this sort of project again if you've got two kids.
I think, yeah, my focus is shifting now, but it's gonna be nice to take my son and daughter out to see Kariyoi one day.
Yeah, yeah.
And but life has massively changed. Like, a lot has happened since 2020.
Yeah, yeah. Not just for you, for everybody.
For everyone.
Yeah, yeah. That is very true. So I want to talk about, like, the history. Actually, we'll go into the geological history in a minute. You presumably have a day job.
Yes, I've got a day job. And like all things, you know, any work I do is a blend of many different things. But so I work at the Waikato Regional Council now, and I started that in late 2022.
Yeah.
And my role is basically to find linkages between traditional Māori knowledge, Mātauranga Māori, and environmental sciences. And that role actually emerged from this project, which also essentially involved a meeting of two different forms of knowledge, right? To understand how Kariyoi formed, its environmental and cultural significance. And that's what I'm doing now. And Regional Council actually supports, you know, the outreach that's involved with the Kariyoi map and the book launch and everything else.
That's often what happens when you get the chance to pursue your passions. Like, it can't not bleed over. You can't not become useful to somebody with the knowledge you gain and the experience you gain. So, right. yeah, that's nice to hear. So, all right, so let's talk history, because, as I said to you off the air, I presume at one point there was no mountain. There was maybe a sea floor, or I don't know, I've got no clues. What was here before magma started coming out of the earth at this location?
Okay, so...
And when was that?
Okay, so let's start about 2.6 million years ago.
Yeah.
That's the beginning of the Pleistocene.
Yeah.
And around that time, the sea was about, you know, 15 to 20 kilometres offshore of where it is now.
Okay, yeah.
So this was a nice lowland area. Whangaroa and Aotea was a lowland area with forested valleys.
Yeah.
And we actually managed to recover a tree stump from that's 2.6 million years.
Wow, really? You found this while you were...
Yeah, and it's perfectly preserved. And it was buried beneath one of the oldest lava flows that occurred 2.6 million years ago from the Bridal Veil Falls area.
So where is the stump now?
It's going to be displayed in the exhibition.
Okay, awesome.
In September.
Wow.
So everyone's going to be able to see these trees.
Mm.
Those are the trees that were growing in the landscape. So it was a sandstone, eroded sandstone landscape, about 30 million year old rocks. You had streams flowing through. You had, you know, mostly covered in forest. And then there were these series of eruptions which began out of nowhere.
Yeah, seemingly. Well, geologically you can tell that there must be a hot spot or something, is there? Because there's a line of activity through Porongia and out the other side.
Yeah, so there's in a sense, there's a hot spot in that. We think that about 2.6 million years ago, the Pacific Plate, which was subducting under this part of the North Island, had actually ripped And it ripped in a northwest-southeast direction, and magma started to come up along that tear and produce these a line of volcanoes, which are Te Kawa, Kakepuku, Pirongia, and then out to Kariwa.
Oh, okay, so it's not a spot, it's a line.
It's a line.
A tear, okay. Okay,
all right. About 65 kilometres long.
Yep.
And so Kariwa is at the edge of that tear, and because it's at the above the edge of the tear, the magma was quite dispersed because you've got the plate sort of ripping apart fully at the edge of the tear, and then magma came up in this big sort of just this widely dispersed area. And so there were all these eruptions in this local area, which began. Okay. One of the earliest was the Bridal Veil Falls or Wairinga eruption. Lava flow went into a valley, it pondered in the valley, got to about 30 metres thick, and it buried this entire forest, which when we go back now, we can actually find the tree stumps exposed beneath the lava flow,
right,
with bark, tree bark still attached.
So is that round under the waterfall itself or just along that whole wall?
It's along the wall. At the waterfall, I don't think you can see the trees, but you can see there's a burnt layer of soil beneath the lava flow.
Yeah.
So it's all preserved quite remarkably. And then there were, after that eruption, there were just many others. Taranaki Point, some eruptions near the modern-day Te Toto Gorge, some near Naranui Beach. And these little scoria cones, like the ones you'd see in Auckland, and tuff rings, kind of like the Orake Basin in Auckland, you know, like sort of an explosion crater with a gently dipping ash ring around it. That's what the landscape transformed into, and it would have been, you know, very damaging to all the forest that was there, redirected all the streams. The landscape would have looked quite barren, quite rocky, quite ash-covered, dusty.
Yeah.
And then from that, about 2.58 million years ago, so just not long after, essentially, Kariwa started to form as a stratovolcano, as a central volcano within this mass of messy scoria cones and tuff rings. The magma sort of consolidated into one area and started to build the central volcano.
And that is in the location where we roughly think the center is now of the mountain?
Yeah, okay. Roughly there.
Okay.
And the way that this has been reconstructed is by going to the coastal outcrops of Kariwa and looking at the succession of rock layers.
So you can see where you can distinguish each lava flow.
Exactly.
And ash. I guess there's layers of ash and layers of lava and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And so there were some fairly big explosions. One of the first lavas that came out in the Kariwa area was this rock or lava type called ankeramite, with these very big crystals of clinopyroxene. And you can find these lava flows as boulders, you know, in Manu Bay, Whale Bay.
Those big round boulders that where there's no sand, it's just boulders.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
And from there, it kind of just kept growing. And there was about 20 lava flows erupted in close succession, so building up a cone that would have looked like Rangitoto Island.
Okay, so not as steep as it currently is.
Not as steep, so quite a gently dipping, a shield-like volcanic structure. And then over the next 100,000 years or so, Kariwa transitioned into a steeper stratovolcano.
So there's just constant eruptions over the millennia, do we say millennia? What do I say? Yeah. Thousands of years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was constant eruptions with some pauses in between, and also, as we now know, happens on other stratovolcanoes like Taranaki or Mount St. Helens. Kariwa would get too steep and then it would collapse under gravity. And so one of those collapses flowed north towards where the Wainui Reserve is. All of that land is a debris avalanche.
So so that's what happened. When you say a mountain collapses, it gets too steep.
Gets too steep.
And it just all falls downhill till it comes to a rest at some point.
Yeah, and it could take only a couple of minutes for the whole thing to fall down.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Taranaki's done that many times.
That'd be pretty frightening.
Yeah, it would be really noisy. It would be, the earth would be rumbling.
So how far away would people feel the rumble?
I think you could probably feel it, you know, probably even Auckland area. Okay. I mean, it'd be a long way away.
So people think there was an earthquake or something. Yeah,
it would register as an earthquake.
Yeah.
And so Taranaki and Ruapehu, they've done this, the same process, collapsing. It's just every stratovolcano in the world essentially does that.
Mm.
So it grow, and then all regrow. So more magma is erupted, the volcano rebuilds.
Yeah.
And then if it gets too steep, it collapses again. Kariwa did it twice. There were two big collapses.
So did it used to be taller?
Yeah, it was definitely taller. I mean, in the sense of the mountain would have probably reached over 1,000 metres, you know, but not, it wasn't.
That's almost double.
Well, it's 756 metres now.
Oh, is it? For some reason, I thought it was 500. I don't know why I think that. I have to wipe that from my brain. So 700 and...
Yeah, 756 metres is the summit trig now.
Okay.
So conservatively, you could say, you know, maybe 1,000, 1,100 metres. We can't rule out that it was taller, but the evidence from the surrounding landscape, the ring plane that we'd call it, doesn't seem to support it being a really, really tall cone. As well as the footprint of the mountain itself, it's not that big. So
if it had been taller, there would have been more stuff to fall down, and it would have to go somewhere.
Yeah,
basically.
In contrast to, you know, Mount Pirongia, which is almost 13 kilometers wide at its base, and that could have supported a very tall mountain. We just don't know. So
okay,
conservatively, yeah. I thought Pirongia 1,350 meters tall.
Yeah,
Kariwa maybe just over 1,000. But, you know, because Kariwa had two collapses during its active volcanic lifespan, it may have been taller, and maybe the deposits are offshore and now underwater.
Okay, so you haven't explored the seafloor or the sea itself.
I haven't been out there myself, but as you see in one of the first figures in the book, the Kariwa book, there is a map which shows some unusual volcanic features offshore towards Kariwa or Gannet Island.
Yeah.
One of the things, when I reviewed the aeromagnetic survey, which was done looking for black sand, this was done in 2008,
yep.
Sinosteel.
Yeah.
I looked at their data, and they had uncovered about 12 volcanoes that are hidden within about 10 kilometres west offshore of Kariwa.
So they're all under the sandy floor or whatever the sea floor is, I don't actually know.
They'll be buried by sand or just other sediment. They're in, you know, 30 metres of water, more or less. And that's kind of significant because it's not common in New Zealand for us to actually discover new volcanoes anymore. I mean, maybe every couple of years there might be a small one found.
So did they tell anyone, or did no one really think about it until you got the data?
I don't think anyone thought about it. I think they were
just looking for iron sand, obviously.
Which is magnetic as well. And basaltic rocks, volcanic rocks, are also magnetic. So they were probably ignoring the volcanic rocks, whereas I was exclusively looking for those.
They probably thought it was a nuisance.
Just, exactly.
Yeah, messing up the data. Had to work harder. Yeah. Okay, so we've got... When did all the... Are we at the point where we can say that when the eruptions all stopped in the story? Have we reached that point?
Well, we can get there. So the eruptive activity at Kariwa began about 2.58 million years ago and ended about 2.4 million years ago.
Okay.
So let's just say it's about 180,000 years of volcanic activity on the main volcano.
Yeah.
The volcanism continued from small scoria cones, such as, you know, Maunga Tawhiri, Ohio Popoko.
See, I didn't know, like, Maunga Tawhiri Road is on, that's a volcano.
Yeah.
It's not just a hill or from other sources. In fact, what you said historically, it was lowlands out here, so there wouldn't have been a lot of ridges.
Yeah, in general, the hills kind of south, immediately south of Raglan and going towards Te Mata. It's all volcanic. They're all small volcanoes.
Right. And including the I know it's not on your map with the Tiuku wind farm, but that area, the wind farm's there because it's up high.
Yeah.
So that's volcanic as well?
Yeah. And if you do the, there's the trail that goes up there, you can actually see red scoria at the top of the, the farm track cuttings and stuff. So
yeah.
The wind farm was built on a lava flow because it's nice and stable rock.
See, now this is the thing. You call that a lava flow, but that's, like, how did that get there? Because it's the highest point in its area.
Yes, yeah, so it appears that, and again, we can look at the aeromagnetic data to confirm this, but there was actually a volcano that erupted on top of that mountain range, and most of it's eroded now.
So that's the range that the Divi is on, the Divi crosses.
Yeah,
right.
Essentially, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, see, that's kind of intriguing. So what, it didn't come from this side, it came from over there.
That's right. So here's a fascinating stat. Just in the onshore region near Karioi, there are more than 50 small volcanic eruption centres alongside the main Karioi Mountain. So more than 50 separate eruption sites occur just between Whangaroa and the Aotea Harbour.
So on your map, can we see where those are, can we?
Yeah, you could see them on the map, and you could probably count them as well, and you'll get about 50. So I've mapped out the location of every definable eruption centre, so you can look at areas of high magnetic rock where there's been an injection of magma, which is frozen now, and it's now solid basalt plug.
Yep.
Or you could see, in the case of Maunga Tawhiri, you know, they've got an actual hill still preserved. There's also some near Te Mata, there's some really unusual, you know, extremely magnetic features which represent deep explosion craters that could be, you know, hundreds of metres deep, probably were filled with lake sediment at one time. And those are what we call Maa craters. So that's where the magma hit groundwater and it just has this massive explosion and generates a very deep hole. And so,
right, okay. It's pretty violent then.
Pretty violent, but what's amazing as well is that I've got colleagues in the South Island who found similar features in Otago, and if you drill into a Maa crater, sometimes you can find fossils of fish or leaves or insects that are millions of years old. Because those explosion craters fill with water and then preserve fossils beautifully.
Yeah.
So maybe at Te Mata there'll be a feature like that.
Okay. Is there anything where, like, you talk about these kind of plugs and little eruption points, is there anywhere that's like really obviously a cone, a little mini cone or something that you go, oh yeah, that's definitely, like a layperson would go, oh yeah, that's definitely something happening there?
I think on the Raglan side, you've got the Opotoru cone, which is a kind of, it'll be sort of southeast of Naranui Beach. There's a very distinct hill rising up out of the side of Karioi. So can you see it there?
Oh, yeah. I'm on the map. We're looking at the map. Okay. Yeah. Now I'm trying to imagine how to look at that.
So,
is that higher? Is that higher around that pink area? Is it lower around all sides of it?
Yeah, it
okay,
is.
Okay, so if you're on the right angle, you would see it.
You'll see it rising up out of the otherwise dipping slopes of Karioi. So that's a very distinct cone. Another would be Houchin's Hill, which is kind of southeast of Te Mata.
Can we say, hold on, I want to interrupt. So is there a road near there or somebody's farm we can say? Was that near Extreme?
It is. It's near. It's Extreme. Extreme Waste is actually on the scoria cone.
On the foot of it.
Yeah.
And that's why it goes up steeply behind it.
Yeah.
And then there's a plateau at the top, which is where our transmitter site is.
Right.
As well as three cell phone towers.
So there you go. Made perfect use of it.
Yeah. And that is. Yes. Yeah, we did. We made good use of it. It was very windy up there, mind you.
Yeah.
Things get blown around.
Yeah,
but
I bet it is.
Okay. Okay. All right. That's cool. So now I know. Whoop. The map's taken off. That's something I know well. I know intimately that area. So stay still, man.
Another one would be, I should mention, you know, Kirikiripu Hill, which is just, which is in Raglan, right?
So, yeah.
as you're driving in, before you get into the town, you'll see there's a hill. It's got a pass site on the top, and that's Kirikiripu, and that's an ancient volcano as well. And Kirikiripu is incredible, maybe unique in New Zealand, in the sense of about 70% of the volume of Kirikiripu's lavas are filled with chunks of the Earth's mantle, which is this bright green crystalline stuff made of olivine. So this lava has brought chunks of the mantle to the surface. So half the lava flow is shining with this green crystalline material.
Is it still molten, or is it?
It's all solidified now.
But when it came up, the bits that came up, like the bits of the mantle, that was still molten.
Believe it or not, so the mantle is largely crystalline, right? And we mentioned this earlier, is the mantle is not really molten. It's crystal material, which then has to melt to form a magma.
Yeah.
So these lavas, which were molten, have carried essentially cold chunks of the mantle up from maybe, 50 plus kilometers down.
So the mantle is a large part of just inside the Earth. You got the core,
yeah,
which, and that's molten,
yeah,
and then you got the mantle outside of that.
Well, the core is solid,
okay,
because it's under so much pressure.
Okay, so that it can't be anything else.
Yeah.
So where does the molten stuff come from then?
So that's actually the key question, right? Is magma is not, it's not, the center of the Earth isn't just sloshing around with magma. It's all under high pressure. It's all crystalline. The reason that we get a magma forming, and particularly in this context, is that subduction has been occurring. The Pacific Plate goes down. The Pacific Plate, which is oceanic crust, is full of water.
Yeah.
That water is being pushed into the mantle. When that water is released via dehydration, it chemically alters the mantle above it.
Yeah.
And makes it susceptible to melting at a lower temperature.
Okay.
So water is the secret ingredient here.
Yeah.
And then that mantle material, which has been flushed by seawater, essentially, it then is able to rise up as a melt. And they're very small volumes of this that occur. So you only need a little bit, and then it reaches up, hits the base of the crust, maybe crystallizes a bit, and then it rises up, and it might form a volcano.
Okay, so now I want to ask about places like Hawaii.
Okay.
Where, as far as I know, that's in the middle somewhere of a plate. And you can see when you look on a map, you can clearly see the line of cones. So how did water get... what's going on there? Is it the same? Is the same thing happening? Because it's not near an earthquake zone, is it?
Necessarily? No, so right. So there's no subduction zone in the middle of the Pacific Plate. So how does that happen? That is a classic hotspot.
Okay.
The other way you can get magma coming up is a huge decompression or upwelling zone from the asthenosphere, the deeper mantle.
Yeah.
And it comes up as a big blob, and you've got a plate that's slowly moving over the top of that blob. Like the Pacific Plate, because it's subducting, right? Elsewhere, yeah. So it's always moving, and that's how you get a hotspot chain like Hawaii, like Tahiti, and that's a very different process.
But is there water getting down there? Or is it not anything to do with water?
It's sort of an anhydrous process. Water is not really a factor there.
Okay.
Yep. And hotspots are a little bit harder to understand. So, but there are other mental dynamics at play that create hotspots. And this is a perfect point to make, because this brings us to the most unusual thing about Kariwai. The reason I probably wanted to map in the first place is at Kariwai and the surrounding small volcanoes, we find two types of magma have been erupted. Subduction type magma.
Yeah.
Which is formed by fluxing of water through the mantle.
Yeah.
And then we have intraplate type magma, which is not related to that process.
So that's more like Hawaii.
Hawaiian style. We have both here. This is one of a few places in the entire world where that's ever occurred.
Right.
It's a very, very unusual phenomena, possibly related to the tearing of the Pacific plates, where you get the best of both worlds. You get some subduction, but you're also getting magma coming up like a hotspot from underneath and rising through the tear.
So it's pretty unique.
It's very unique, and it's genuinely hard to explain how that happened.
I know you've been working with experts in Japan.
Yeah.
And to my mind, that's a very similar kind of country geologically. Do they have things like that over there?
Japan has, it's sort of like subduction zone central. So Japanese scientists and New Zealand scientists often work together. And I mean, shout out to Chris Conway, who's a co-author on this book. Chris actually mapped Mount Ruapehu during his PhD, which is pretty amazing. And Chris provided the age dating for this project with Osamu Shizuka, who's his mentor in the research space. And Japan has a lot of subduction-related volcanism. It also has intraplate volcanism. To the best of my ability, I don't think that they overlap in as closely as it does here.
Yeah.
But Japan definitely has both types of volcanism. You've got intraplate and subduction-related going on in the same island setting.
Yeah.
What's really kind of unusual at Kariwa is how they're in the exact same place erupting from the same volcano.
Yeah.
And but that's not to say that this won't be uncovered elsewhere in the world. But at this point, you know, I've done a...
Well, would we have not known until you did this?
This has been known for some time. And, you know, again, I give thanks to my other co-author, Roger Briggs. So Roger was a long-time member of the Earth Science Department, University of Waikato. He was really the one who uncovered that story.
Right, okay.
And he was abseiling down Te Tauira Gorge before I was born, mm-hmm. looking for this stuff. Yeah, and yeah. And a lot of this work reflects that kind of foundation that he built through his own research, and I've gone in and added all the details and connected the dots on the map. But this has been known for some time. One of the objectives of mapping was to figure out exactly where the subduction-type rocks and the intraplate rocks occur, because on Kariwa itself, there was a lot of uncertainty. As soon as you get away from the coast, where it's kind of obvious,
yeah,
the upper mountain, it's really hard to see the rocks. So you've got to walk everywhere and figure out how it all fits together. How does the top of the mountain relate to what you see on the coast?
So what are you actually doing up there? I mean, are you digging things? Do you have devices like ultrasound devices or something like that? I'm pulling words out of the back of my head here. But
no, it's very, very simple. I go up with a camera, a compass, a GPS. I take notes on the rocks I find. So maybe you take a small rock sample with the rock hammer, check the texture. If it's a really fresh sample, maybe I do a chemical analysis on it. But basically, I'm just trying to document which rocks occur where.
Mm.
And that's not high-tech stuff. That's just a lot of...
A lot of leg work.
Yeah.
So you've been all over the mountain then?
Been most places. There's still some spots that, you know, I never went to, but...
Would it have been possible, like the Kariwa project a few years before you started, they put tracks all through for their work?
Yeah.
That must have been hugely helpful.
Yeah, and actually, all of the tracks from the Kariwa project are shown on this map.
Oh, okay.
So that it show that, and that helps to inform, kind of give the reader an idea of where I've actually walked. So done the tracks, but then there's a lot of off track stuff, getting into valleys, various ridge lines and places that wouldn't make sense to go from a, you know, trapping perspective. There were many field trips I did. You know, you walk up a valley for 13 hours and you find no rocks. And so you've got to be very strategic.
Yes. And maybe you just have bad days as well, I guess.
There are always good days.
Yeah, you can always know. You always know if you go right up the top, you're going to find stuff.
Exactly. If you look for the pointy peaks, there's always a bit of rock exposed. And
So is it like ridge lines or valleys? Like
pretty much.
Because the water digs out the rocks from top, does it?
Valleys are really tricky. There's big boulders everywhere. So you can see nice boulders, but...
You don't know where they've come from.
No, it could be usually from the top of the mountain. So
okay.
Yeah, I had limited success with valleys. It's really... Look in the coastal cliffs, get a really good idea of what the order of the stratigraphy is, and then go up the top of the mountain and try and reconcile. You know, if you see a lava flow in a cliff, where did that come from? Came from the top of the mountain somewhere, probably. And so it's like connecting the dots.
So if we look at Te Toro Gorge, like that's, what do you call that? Sort of.
So it's a, Te Toro Gorge is a very amazing landform. It's a collapse, a sector collapse of the mountain.
And it's an amphitheater now.
It's an amphitheater.
I think that's the word you used.
Caused by a massive landslide that happened a long time after Kariwoi finished erupting.
The thing I don't understand, like it's not perfectly vertical, but it's pretty much a vertical cliff.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Like, how does a landslide stop with such a perfect vertical cliff?
Well, it's like a horseshoe-shaped or a U-shaped collapse scarp, and the...
Oh, so that's the collapse line.
Yeah, the head of the scarp tends to be about vertical, and then it sort of bottoms out and it rotates. And so all of that material's, well, most of it is now offshore.
Yeah.
And there's several examples of those around the coast of Kariwoi. And by the way, on the map...
Yeah, what have we got? Like,
well,
four,
Whale
five,
Bay.
Six, seven... Of eight of them or something like that?
Yeah, so the areas...
Oh, and around Ruapuki as well, I haven't even seen that.
Both Manu Bay and Whale Bay are collapse scarps. That's why they're nice. That's why we have a lagoon at Whale Bay.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a chunk of the mountain that's fallen out. And then Manu Bay as well, you know, you've got a fairly flat amphitheater-like structure above the surf break, and that's another one of these. It's a smaller one, but it's another one.
And we've got sea cliffs that rock climbers like as well.
Yeah.
There's actually a lot for rock climbers around here, which I don't know if you've met Gareth on Raglan Rock. He'd probably be quite enthusiastic about.
He'd be good to chat to.
Yeah. The information. He loves rocks. So, folks, we're talking to Dr. Oliver McLeod, who's just produced his map and book, Geology of Kariwoi Volcano. And you are doing... Now, when is the book launch? It's on the 7th of September.
Yep, 11 a.m. And that's at the Stewart Street Hall.
Yeah. And so, but the people... It's not the patrons. What do you call the people who helped out?
The patrons.
The patrons have already been sent their copies.
Yeah. There's just a few more left to go out. But most
so, if you haven't got yours, folks, it might still be coming.
Yeah. But... Basically, yeah, those were sent out at the start of the week, so they'll be in most people's hands now.
Okay.
And yeah, there'll be copies of the book available at the launch, and also some maps that are not folded, because most of the maps are folded in the books, but some people want maps unfolded for the wall, right?
Pristine. Yes. Yeah. That sounds good.
In a map tube. Yeah.
Are you into signing your?
I definitely can sign the books, the crowdfund one for sign.
Okay.
So, if people want that, definitely can do that.
Okay. As New Zealanders, we're not very good at like putting ourselves out like that. So.
Yeah.
But some people may or may not want that to happen. And what happens with this now? Like, can people can enjoy it and they enjoy to know about the area that they live? Is it useful for things as well? Like, it's not like we want to exploit the mountain. That's the last thing that's going to be happening, but, well, hopefully.
Yeah.
But, yeah, what do we do with the information? Or what do you do, or the science community do?
So for the general public, I hope it strikes up inspiration to visit all of these amazing geological sites in Lemonga and the surrounding landscape. You know, I hope it inspires young people to do their own environmental-based research. I hope that it opens doors in terms of collaboration and dialogue between science and Mātauranga Māori, which is a whole aspect of this project I haven't touched on much here. But
So that was like source information or original information for you as well?
Yeah, and a kind of emphasis on whakapapa as a way of understanding landscapes, and which also brings in people and their connection to place.
Yeah.
So kind of going beyond traditional geoscience into people and place. And so I really hope that the work has some impact in that space. in the international science context, you know, I've got a lot of work to do to tour this map around in the Americas. That's all coming up next year.
So you're hoping to go over there, or are we zooming?
No, I'll be in person. Yeah.
Okay.
And
do you get like invited to do things like that once you've done some work like?
You do. You get invitations, and you know, I've seen similar examples of this kind of volcanism in Mexico, for instance, and so maybe there'll be comparative or case studies to be done. You know, Cuddy always one example, and maybe another from Mexico or elsewhere in North America. There's probably more papers to write, you know, in the academic journals. And the thing is with a map is there is so much now that has to be unpacked. So you present the map, and then there's a pause.
Yeah.
Thinking, what does all this actually mean? Because I've just mapped out where everything occurs.
Yeah.
But now what's the story that tells in terms of how magmas have traveled through the crust below Cuddioi? Why is the distribution significant of the arc and intra plate rocks? There's also cultural aspects of the story to explore. For instance, all of the pa that have been mapped out on top of sand dunes or volcanic features. You know, what's all that about? What's the distribution of those? There's so many angles that can come off this. There's actually probably decades of spin-off research that can come from it.
Yeah.
Whether it's me or others, you know.
Might there's some PhD students coming through, some master students coming through now potentially.
Well, it'll be good, but there aren't that many masters and PhDs in local geoscience right now.
Okay.
So, but you know, 30 years down the line, there might be another wave or...
So is there, at Waikato University, is there a department or a...
Yeah. Yeah, we have... there's a geoscience kind of department.
Yes.
And geoscience is just in a kind of retreating space right now. So this work is kind of a bit of an anomaly.
Yeah. Like you said at the start, the Kickstarter was a key to making it happen.
That's also why I feel a bit of a responsibility to put in a good word for, you know, for geoscience, because it is getting hammered.
Yeah, our universities have, I mean, there's a whole discussion there about how universities have been turned into certificates for meal tickets, like, as opposed to places of research and learning and investigation and that sort of thing over the last, well, it's 30 years, over 30 years since I was at university, exactly 30, actually, thinking about it. Anyway, that was just the start of that change back then.
Yeah.
And we used to have the DSIR, you're probably too young to remember the DSIR.
I'm too young to remember it myself, but I've got colleagues.
I don't feel like I do remember it myself. I just know it was a thing that was stopped in the 90s, I think. So
right.
Yeah, and where research and knowledge was, you didn't have to be able to point to a profit or something like that. It was known to be useful for its own. I don't know. It was just a different attitude toward that. You might do research, you might not know what it could be used for, and then 20 years later, somebody might use it for something like.
And you know, I guess that's the kind of spirit or the philosophy that the Kariwa map came from. And that's what makes it kind of a bit of an anomaly, is that I don't think there are many scientists who could justify spending 4 years mapping in this way. And so that's why, again, you know, I think all the supporters of the work, because that's how this happened. This would not be funded in university. There's just no way now.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's an example of when the community backs a scientist, you can still create these bubbles of meaningful kind of grassroots research, you know, primary level research. But it's these are becoming pretty rare now.
Mm. Well, times will change too. I mean, one day attitudes might change again.
Yeah.
So it's time for us to wrap up. Just remind people that the book launch with Oliver is going to be 7th of September, 11 a.m. at the Stewart Street Church Hall. Now, we've talked about a lot of stuff. I hope there's stuff that we didn't talk about. Are you doing a talk there?
There'll be like a 20-minute presentation, and what
there'll be pictures, which is what we can't do here on the radio.
Yeah, pictures. Yeah. What everyone's going to hear a lot more of is the Te Ao Māori perspective from a panel of kaumātua.
Right.
So the way we're structuring it, it's not just me standing up and talking about everything for an hour. It's going to be much more interactive and a reflection on whakapapa Māori, on geoscience, the past, present and future of Kariwa. And we're approaching it from that angle. We're going to be, you know, inclusive. We're going to, it's multidisciplinary, community-based.
Yeah.
And I think that captures the essence of the philosophy of the project. And I think it's going to be a really great event and quite unique in that sense.
Yeah. And I'm also glad because we got about halfway through and I was like, oh, am I giving away everything you're going to say at the event? And people will be like, I've heard the podcast. I don't need to go to the event. But it's obviously going to be
the map.
It's going to be different as well. It is going to be that whole aspect, which we can't do when it's just you and me anyway.
Exactly.
That's going to be part of that. Oh, that sounds excellent. Look, thank you for coming in this morning. I assume you've taken a little bit of time off work.
Yeah.
But this is much more important. So
yeah, thank you, Aaron.
Glad you could do it. Thanks for coming in, Oliver.